Hey, Whiskey Ring fans, lucky episode number 13. Welcome to the Whiskey Ring podcast. We're bringing you the people who make whiskey interesting. Today's podcast is with Stauning Whiskey, all the way from the west coast of Denmark. I came across Stauning by accident, if I'm being honest, but was taken with their story and with their process. Plus, it's the first Danish whiskey I've ever tried, so either way, you know, had some questions. Joining me to answer these questions is Alex Munk, who co-founded Stauning along with eight friends, it's nine total for those counting, in 2005. While not yet super well known in the US, Stauning is a legend in Denmark and in the Nordic area. What started as nine friends from disparate backgrounds, none of which were the distilling, by the way, is now a massive enterprise, nearing a million LPAs with backing from Diageo and Distill Ventures. You should seriously take a look at their site. I mean, the pictures are simply stunning, and it really shows what they're doing there. As we all know, though, pretty pictures don't mean good whiskey. Stauning, however, has a great recommendation behind it. As Alex said on the podcast and has also said in separate interviews, Stauning's meteoric rise coincided with the rise of new Nordic cuisine. So it's heralded by acclaimed chefs like Magnus Nilsson, formerly of Faviken, and René Redzepi of Noma. The latter chef's restaurant, which is in Copenhagen, features Stauning as the only whiskey on their menu. I can't emphasize how cool that is to foodies like me who also enjoy whiskey. I mean, it's just a perfect match. Plus, as much as Stauning's whiskey absolutely speaks for itself, having one of the best chefs in the world choose to exclusively serve your whiskey is a hell of a mark of approval. Stauning sent me three samples of their whiskeys ahead of the recording, and all the tasting notes will be posted ahead of this coming out. As always, editorial control remains with me, but given what I've just said, I think you know how those reviews will be. You can find Stauning online at stauningwhiskey.com. That's stauningwhisky.com, where they're proudly presenting their newly earned Whiskey Magazine Icons of Whiskey Award for Brand Innovator of the Year 2021. Their socials are also included in the show notes, so you can follow them and see where they're coming next to a retailer near you. If you haven't yet, please follow Whiskey My Wedding Ring and the Whiskey Ring Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and on Twitter at Whiskey Ring, and subscribe to the newsletter on whiskeymyweddingring.com. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the site and the podcast. You can help out for as little as $2.50 a month on Patreon, and trust me, folks, every little bit helps when getting all this stuff together. Thank you also to our sponsors, Mash and Grape and Cairncraft. You can subscribe to the Whiskey Ring Podcast on your favorite podcast platform today. We are on Podbean, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and most other major podcast platforms. Every subscription and listen helps us get sponsors, secure guests, and ultimately get more content to you. As always, thank you so much for listening and for supporting, and please enjoy my chat with Alex Munk from Stauning Whiskey. There we go. All right. So welcome to another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking all about Stauning Whiskey from Denmark. And today, we've got Alex Munk with us, co-founder of Stauning. So Alex, welcome.
Thank you very much, David. I'm thrilled to be here today.
Wonderful, wonderful. So Stauning was, and really Danish whiskey in general, was not on my radar for a long time. It's definitely one of the countries that gets overshadowed by the Big Five, of course. But really in Denmark and in the Nordic region, Scandinavian region in general, the whiskey scene has been picking up quite a bit recently. So you know, before we dive into Stauning in particular, I'd love to hear just what the whiskey landscape looks like up there right now.
Well, I think in 15 years ago, something like that, things started to take off in regards to whiskey in the Nordics. I think it was McMurra in Sweden that kind of started off with the first single malt whiskey in the Nordics. It was probably because the Swedes kind of took single malt whiskey to them in Sweden. They've kind of discovered single malt whiskey after many years of not actually tasting it or drinking it. and brought it back to Systembolaget in Sweden. And, you know, Systembolaget is a pretty special system. Once you are in with your whiskey in Sweden, you are in all shops in Sweden. And the Swedes can only buy their product in this one kind of shop, Systembolaget shop. So so if you bring something exciting in, a lot of Swedes will immediately like or taste this. So they found interest in single malt and, you know, in the Nordics, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland. We look at each other, you know, what's going on? And at some point, Danes looked at the Swedes and were like, interesting, you know, whiskey, single malt whiskey. And McMurra started up making whiskey. And again, Danes looked at the Swedes, interesting, making whiskey. Oh, wow. So I think that's what kind of kicked it off a long time ago now. That was not why we started. That was a totally different reason, but I can come back to that later on. And now, well, I think in Denmark, there's 15, 20 distilleries making whiskey now. Rapid growth over the last 10 years. Most of them are very small. We are the biggest in Denmark and one of the biggest in the Nordics also. We actually are the biggest distillery in Denmark now, which doesn't say a lot because we only make, or we produce 800,000 liters, or we'll produce 800,000 liters this year. So it's not a big distillery. And there's also a lot of distilleries in Sweden and Norway coming up now, Finland also, and, you know, Germany. So it's really spreading very fast now. And I think could actually say that maybe the Nordics are kind of a new area for whiskey, not only one of the countries, but the area Scandinavia might be a region of a lot of interesting whiskey popping up.
Definitely. And that's really what I meant by the, by being overshadowed, at least for now, by the big five regions, you know, US, Canada, Japan, Scotland, Ireland. But as you mentioned, you know, Scandinavia as a group, at the rate that you just mentioned, I mean, it might be country by country soon enough, but certainly as a group, plus Germany as well, France, I know it's got like 50 or 60 distilleries right now. And these are all, and again, this is a generalization, but these are all countries and cultures that aren't necessarily associated with whiskey right away, like maybe perhaps more so with beer or with mead or, you know, lower proof alcoholic beverages, but whiskey is more of a new introduction. So here's what do you think is driving the Danish or the Nordic interest in whiskey?
Well, the Nordics has been famous and probably only famous in the Nordics for the aquavit. you know, France has its eau de vie and the cognac and brandy, Spain and all that. That's a stronger alcohol. And Germany also their Upsala and your high proof alcohol. But I think what kicks things off in the Nordics is actually the kind of the food wave, the Nordic food philosophy that started up with probably a Noma, restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, you know, looking at your region. What is the best products in your region? What can raw materials, how can you use them? And how can you use them in a better way than in the past? So Noma has become quite famous in the food industry about, you know, looking at local produce, the raw materials, how can you use that? Don't buy tomatoes from Spain, but, you know, grow, use your root beet from Denmark. And I think we are kind of looking at this philosophy the same way in the spirits world in Scandinavia. So grain, we really grow a lot of grain, barley, wheat, rye in Denmark and the Nordics. We export a lot of grain for Scotland, also for single malt whiskey, a lot of export for beer in Germany. So we're quite good and we have good soil, good area for growth of grain. I think having that in your backyard, you know, all that fantastic raw material, the locally produced, kind of, you know, it's like, why don't we use that? And most then starts up with the barley, because that's what they did in Scotland, what we do in Scotland and in Ireland. And then you start to focus on other things that might be interesting because you have this natural interest to experiment and play and find out how can we use our local produce for other flavors. other types of alcohol. And whiskey is super interesting right now. I think you had gin, of course, huge wave of gin. You had aged rum for a period, and automatically you go from kind of gin to aged rum, and the next step is then whiskey, and then smoked whiskey, peat smoked whiskey. So a lot of people from this gin and aged rum wave now finds their way into whiskey. And as they also then are supported by this new Nordic food philosophy, it's very natural to exploit the possibilities in whiskey in different styles. So they look to other regions of the world, US, as you said, Japan, Australia is also doing quite well at the moment, and to see what are they doing. A lot of Danes are naturally looking for, you know, Scotland, what's going on in Scotland, kind of the original whiskey. Could be Irish whiskey, but I think Scottish whiskey is more famous in Denmark. So we started looking at that, and now things are really from the US really starting to happen. You know, a lot of microbreweries, we've had that for many years, going into micro distilleries. So the focus has come on the US and how you, in a better way, play around with things and are curious on stuff. So we look a lot at the US right now, actually.
Fascinating. Love it. So right before we go into Stauning in particular, and I promise we will get directly to Stauning, is I'm just curious about the climate, and I guess the terroir there too, but especially the, you know, the climate and the context in which you're distilling.
Yeah. So Denmark is a very small country, extremely small, 5 to 6 million people. Some even believe that Denmark is the capital of Sweden. You know, it's a very small country. We live at the west coast in Denmark. Stauning whiskey is situated at the west coast. Windy, sandy soil, wet, flat. We have the sea like 1.5 kilometer from Stauning. It's a fjord, or actually it's a fjord, and on the other side of that fjord, you have the west coast, the sea. So I would say a bit like actually like Scotland, Islay, but no cliffs in Denmark. So a flat Islay, I would say. But our style doesn't reflect or doesn't match the Islay types of whiskey, mostly because we don't use the peat, that's kind of seaweed, iodine, salty stuff they have at Islay. So more like a mainland kind of Scottish whiskey, but situated at the west coast.
Wonderful. So with that, let's get into Stauning, and correcting my pronunciation there, Stauning.
Stauning is perfect.
Yeah. And the distillery itself. So let's talk the founding and all about it.
Yep. Well, Stauning started in 2005. We're 9 founders in Stauning Whiskey. It was one of my friends, Martin, that heard a radio program about whiskey in 2005. He was going to the summer house. And in this program, they said, it's easy to make whiskey, but it's difficult to make a good whiskey. And he went to the summer house and met up with his family. And he discussed the, you know, whiskey. Does anybody in Denmark makes whiskey? You know, have you heard about a Danish whiskey? He asked them. And he said, no, whiskey. Why? You know, we make, you know, aquavit in Denmark, not whiskey. And they continued discussing this. And they were sitting there looking into the, you know, the bonfire, having a beer, and probably also a whiskey at some point of time, and discussing the possibilities. And they went to Google, looked it up, you know, Denmark exports grain for whiskey to Scotland. Interesting. Then we might be a possibility to make a whiskey in Denmark. You know, why not? If you can grow the grain, then you can do the rest. The family was Martin, Jesper, and Lasse. Three brothers, and the father Mogens, and the mother's brother Henning. And they were like, but Martin, we don't know anything about whiskey. You know, how can we start a project like this? And he said, okay, let's call some friends. There might be somebody out there that knows a bit more about whiskey than us. But he made a list of friends and started calling those friends. And I'm luckily one of those friends. I've been studying engineering with Lasse, the younger brother to Martin. And I remember him calling me and say, Alex, would you like to start the first Danish whiskey distillery? And he thought it was the first Danish. It wasn't, but he thought that at a point of time. And I was like, why not? You know, instead of starting playing, you know, badminton or football or, you know, handball or something like that, could be potentially be more fun making a whiskey distillery. So I said yes. And we met up at Martin's house in Silkeborg. Silkeborg is a village, city in the mid part of Denmark, 90 kilometers actually from the distillery. And Lasse and Martin Jesper had made this PowerPoint presentation about whiskey. You know, so they went to Google, they wrote how to make whiskey. And Google then came up with about 10 million hits on how to make whiskey. And they kind of, let's take that one. And made this PowerPoint presentation where, it said it's easy to make whiskey. You know, you have grain, you have water, you have yeast, you make a beer, you distill that beer, boom, you have whiskey. And we were like, amazing, great, let's do it. So I think we were 14 people at Martin's house. And after some time, you know, time went and we, you know, went to Google again and bought some books about distilling and making beer and whiskey. And we ended up being 9 founders of Stauning Whiskey. So the year, 1 year after, we made our first new make. And this was a group of people that is very different this day today also. So we have 4 construction engineers, and we are a helicopter pilot, a doctor, a chef, a butcher, and a teacher. So we can imagine 9 very different, you know, professions and different people. And so how is that a good idea? Often when you hear about 9 founders going together, it's a bad idea. No more than 3 is a good idea. Right. We knew, the 4 engineers, that we could work together because we've been studying together. Mm-hmm. And you know, the doctor is good at enzymes, bacteria. You have the butcher and the chef, good at food, handling food, again, bacteria, enzymes. You have the teacher, Hans Martin. He was the guy that knew most about whiskey. He'd been to Scotland visiting distilleries. That was the only one that had visited distilleries. The helicopter pilot. Why helicopter pilot? And Jesper, the helicopter pilot, he's just very exact with everything. You know, we don't make mistakes. If you make a mistake, the helicopter will fall to the ground. Not possible. So every time you kind of try to jump, every time you kind of tried to jump the, you know, the low part of the fence, you know, he was just like, no. Mm-hmm. Keep up the, you know, the exact and good work, guys. So it was good to have him also. And then we started up making whiskey in Mons, the butcher's abattoir, his butchery abattoir, which was in the back part of his private house. And the reason why it was there was because Stauning is, you know, outskirts of Denmark, west coast. So low prices, you know, housing, all that. East part of Denmark, where we all lived, was extremely high in price. We couldn't get a production facility to make this whiskey. So it was just easy to start up in Mons Butchery, because making whiskey is making food. So you need the permit to make food. And so we started up. And how do you do that in an abattoir? Well, there was this freezer where you would hang the meat, you know, in this, I think, 8 square meter freezer, something like that, or fridge, big fridge. And we could floor malt in there. And we could control the temperature. And we wanted to make everything from scratch, because we didn't know anything. You know, the best way of learning is doing. So grow the grain, you know, floor malt, as you did 200 years ago, 100 or 50 years ago. We could dry the grain and smoke it in the chimney where you would smoke the meat. You could grind the grain in the meat grinder. Not easy, but we could do it. It was kind of quite a hassle to do that. You could do the mashing in the he had big bowls he could heat up when he made different, you know, I can't remember the word for that, special kinds of food. So everything was in place to make the whiskey in the abattoir. So the first whiskey was kind of, you know, made in a, or alcohol was made in an abattoir with the tools from the butchery, from the abattoir. And that was in 2006. And we wanted to make a kind of a whiskey similar to Artbeck from 1977. And we had tasted this whiskey at the first whiskey trade show in Denmark in 2003 when we were studying engineering. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, that stuff was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I was going to say that was a very specific, like Ardbeg 1977.
Yeah. Kind of end period of 70s, you know, before they started their new distillery. Mm-hmm. We kind of, okay, what do you need to make an Ardbeg from 1977? You need peat. That's number one. So we found a local peat bog where they actually had a peat museum. They were thrilled to help us with, you know, the peat, you know, because they could then in their museum they could tell that they were actually digging up peat for whiskey production in 2006. Mm-hmm. So we got all the peat for free from this place, this peat is extremely old peat. It's from mainland Denmark, kind of, you know, like it's not coastal. So it's a sweet, kind of simple kind of peat. It's not like, it doesn't taste like the Islay peat with the seaweed, iodine, kind of sea style, boat style like whiskey. It's more like Highland Scotch peat. So we could do that and use it for the first batch, and I think 2 months after, can't really remember, but a short while after making the first new make, we did that in the abattoir, sitting summertime with two pot stills, 400-liter pot still, a 200-liter pot still, pot still from Portugal, alembic stills, handmade alembic stills. With paella burners under the stills, you know, like, you know, I would imagine somewhere in the woods in the US, some guys were sitting doing the same.
probably a little less sophisticated, but yeah, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. We could then start up, and it took, so Mons was preparing all this, the butcher, making the beer. We'd got the permit from the food department and the tax department, and then we could start up making this. And it took a weekend, had our first new make, and a short while after, a couple of months after, we met Jim Murray from the Whiskey Bible, and he said, "This stuff is absolutely amazing. You know, this reminds me of Ardbeg from the end period of the 70s." And we were just like, "What? What are you saying? You know, are you kidding?" And I think it was probably due to the kind of the low key traditional way of making whiskey, you know, direct heated stills, floor malted, really special way of mashing, where we got a lot of solids into the wort and into the wash. And when you then distill this with all of these solids, you get a lot of, you know, scorching inside the still. Mm-hmm. That make this very fruity, full, complex new make. And this was only the new make he tasted, but still, this smoky, fruity new make was pretty interesting for him. So he convinced us to kind of start a real distillery. That was only a hobby, you know, in the beginning. The goal was to make 200 liters of whiskey. And he said, "Why don't you make a rye whiskey?" Because my favorite whiskey, he said, is rye whiskey. And you have all this rye in Denmark. Denmark is, you know, we eat rye bread. When you open
you're famous for rye.
Exactly. Yeah. When you open the lunchbox in school, the kids' lunchbox in school, you will see rye bread. You know, you eat it for lunch. Everybody in Denmark eats it, so it's very natural for us to use the rye. So he said, "I see rye fields all over the place. Why don't you use the rye?" And so much more original than making a copy of Scotch whiskey. You know, the Japanese do that. You know. Why would you like to do that, making this refined single malt whiskey? And we're like, yeah, well, why not? So we started making rye whiskey also in 2009, we started making in the old farm we bought in 2007, we started making rye whiskey and single malt whiskey. So that was kind of the beginning of starting whiskey.
So you said you thought at the time that you were the first, but that you weren't the first. Who beat you out?
So I can't remember the exact year, but in the 1950s, mm-hmm. there was a Danish distillery making whiskey, It was actually the distillery that are famous for making aquavit in Denmark. They imported a Scotch master distiller to Roskilde near Copenhagen, and he made a whiskey and a rum and a gin or something like that. I guess the whiskey in that, you know, that those days weren't very popular in Denmark, so they stopped pretty quickly. I think 10 years after it wasn't a big success. The whiskey is named Clock, CLOC. I think you can find some bottles in Denmark somewhere, but I've heard that it's not especially good. There was a small winery in Bornholm, a small island in Denmark, that he had a beer, as I remember the story, and he had a beer that failed somehow, and he distilled that beer in some homemade equipment for distilling and put it on a wine cask. And then actually, you know, he had a whiskey, you know, and he kind of beat us with a couple of months or something like that. We didn't know. So, but again, it's not important who was the first lady, you know, in 2000. It was made in 1950 something. So yeah, no reason discussing now, that.
I mean, your timing is much, much better. I mean, that would have been right at the start of the whiskey glut around the world. It would have been really the, especially in the US, I know like bourbon just started tanking around that time and going down. And that was really the rise of the, you know, clear spirits. Like I said, the gins, the vodkas, and they took over for decades. But 2005, you know, early to mid aughts, was like the perfect time to start a distillery around the world. It's when everything is just starting to rise up. It's after the beer boom, started the whiskey boom.
Yeah.
So I was wondering too about, so definitely the rye makes absolute sense. I mean, it's, I tried some of the Astounding Rye last night. It was really excellent, but it was also notably different. So,
yes.
you know, now I've had rye from, okay, so obviously American rye and the different variations therein. I've had Canadian rye, had a German rye, I'm trying to think. The Kilbeggan rye from Ireland. And I had a Polish rye.
Okay.
But, you know, I hadn't had a Danish rye or larger Nordic rye. And it was remarkable how different the flavor profile was.
Yeah.
You know, the American rye, usually I think of it really whatever, in whatever percentage you use it at, it tends to be very spicy, peppery, like a lot of black peppercorn, pink peppercorn, can be very minty as well. And this is all, again, depends on the rye, depends on the state, but I'm generalizing just for the point here. But this rye was very soft. You know, it was very drinkable. It was sweet. It was caramelly. And is that, I'm curious if that is a just part of what Danish rye is as both a crop and a product. You know, is that the Danish quote unquote style of rye?
No, it's not the Danish style of rye. it's a stounding style of rye. When we shifted from making, or we didn't shift, but when we started making rye whiskey, we wanted to make it, you know, kind of our own style, and it's made like a single malt whiskey. So it's a rye made like a single malt whiskey. So we still floor malt rye also. So we floor malt barley and we floor malt rye. All our, you know, all the grain we use is floor malted, and still it still is, and that changes the rye, the flavors of the rye, the malting the rye, and then again we, as I mentioned, we have a super special way of mashing, and I can't show you, but I would say it reminds of a washing machine somehow. In the beginning, we tried to use a Lauderton for this, but everybody that's tried to work with rye will nod when I say it's a super difficult grain to work with. It's very sticky. It tends to make kind of some balls around some of the dry parts of the rye. So you really have a hard time using all of the starch in there. when you use a kind of a standard way of meshing, as you would do with a single mold. So we had to change our way of meshing to really kind of dissolve the starch and really make the enzymes work with the liquid. And so we invented this special washing machine that really could kind of mix it around and get the water in at all the small parts. One of the other benefits with this was we could actually extract some of these benefits. Some would say it's a disadvantage, but you get a lot of solids out of this. Got a lot of the flour goes into the wort. Today, when you see a mash tun and when you see the wort, it's the clear wort. Mm-hmm. We have a very thick, greasy, dark type of wort. And when we have distillers coming from Scotland, they often say, this is how it looked in the old days. You know, when I was a boy going to distilleries, this is the wort we would see, you know, really thick, cloudy, greasy kind of sticky wort. What that does when it goes into to the wash still afterwards, when you then have an open fired still, it kind of you have this Maillard reaction on the inside of the still. It really, we have 750 degrees fire kind of going on the copper pot still, leads heat extremely well, and it kind of scorches these solids that falls to the bottom of the stills and create these really fruity. You can extract these really fruity esters that we had from the washbacks from the fermentation. So we get a fruity, sweet rye new make by doing this. And we actually won two years ago, must be, in World Whiskies Awards with World's Best New Make, because it's very drinkable, even as a new make, because it's so fruity and sweet. And I also guess that the type of stills we use, alembic stills, you know, actually the kind of the oldest type of stills ever made from Arabic countries, you know, to make perfume, to get really extract the flavors from the raw material you used. So we get some of these really fruity flavors again from the type of the still, and small stills again, a bigger surface area to the volume. It's 2,000 liter stills. We have we have 16 wash stills and 8 spirit stills at the distillery, so 24 stills. So we've tried to keep them small, again, to really get the full flavors out of the raw material. So you have a fruity single malt whiskey, a kind of single malt, whiskey production style, but a rye. The mash bill is 70% rye and 30% barley. And we've dialed up and down on this. We effectively changed it in the new distillery that we just finished 2 years ago, because we wanted to, you know, when we went from the old farm to the new distillery, wanted to keep the profile of the new make. We had to do some changes in the mash bill. If we do it 100% rye, it would actually remind more of the American types of rye we discovered. But we really don't want to make a copy of an American rye, because Americans do rye quite well. We like that style. We don't want to make a Scotch single malt whiskey, because the Scots actually do a really cool and very well tasting single malt whiskey. We want to do our own profile of whiskey in Denmark or in the Nordics. So we've really tried to get our own style. And it's a young whiskey still. It's 3.5 years old, the stuff you've tasted. But I actually think, and we think, that it has its own, you know, it's beautiful in its own way when it's young, because you really get that distillery character. You get some vibrance in the alcohol when it's young. And when it's older, it kind of starts reminding of other types of whiskey. So we would like to keep it at these 3 to 5, maybe 6 years of age maximum with our whiskeys.
Definitely. And, you know, just for reference, so Stauning was generous enough to send samples of the rye whiskey, the smoke whiskey, and Chaos as well. So we just talked about the rye one, go through the other two as well. But I mean, what you just said is absolutely what I tasted in each of the whiskeys. You know, I've said before in the podcast, I'm someone who's very sensitive to over oaking and things that are just too old. And there was none of that in there. There was enough oak to give a little bit of pepperiness, a little creaminess in there, but the wood character wasn't wasn't the star. It really was the grain. Mm. And the mouthfeel came across with the definitely the fruitiness, the softness and the creaminess there as well. And that really goes for all three of them, even though, you know, obviously the rye being different grain from the other two. I also wanted to just throw in there, because you're talking about the floor malting and washing machine style wash bag, is that, you know, if people go to the website, to stoundingwhiskey.com, that's whiskey without an E, that, you know, it's the pictures there are amazing. Not only are they just beautiful, it's what you kind of picture a Nordic countryside to be in a way. But, you know, you have pictures of what this really long alley almost of malting grain looks like, and what that looks like to floor malt, and what the stills look like. You know, you think of, I think if someone hears 24, you have 24 stills.
Yeah.
You know, I know you already addressed it there. There's a smaller size, but if you just heard 24 stills, you're like, oh my God, you're getting into the big boy range at that point. That's just a lot of volume. But at 2000 liters per, and then a 16 and 8 division, it is, yes, it's 24, but like you said, it's smaller. It's more control over each of them. It's a smaller batch size, and it really does come across. And so with the pot stills and with the Olympic stills, you said they're direct fire, they're gas fired, direct fire underneath, getting to that really, really high temperature and scorching. So are you moving the mash around much inside the still while you're making it, or are you really just kind of letting it sit and just distill as it goes?
The Whiskey Ring podcast is now brought to you by Mash and Grape. I'm a huge fan of Mash and Grape. They ship to most states nationwide. They have great private selections and a great membership program called the Dark Spirit Society, of which I'm a member, that gets you even more private selections plus free shipping on orders over $95 anywhere that they ship. For Whiskey and My Wedding Ring fans and Whiskey Ring podcast listeners, Mash and Grape is offering 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription, prepaid or ongoing. Just use code WHISKEYRING at checkout. That's mashandgrape.com. Search Mashbox Club and use code WHISKEYRING at checkout for 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription. The Whiskey Ring podcast is also brought to you by Cairn Craft. I use Cairn Craft's Cairn Caddy bamboo glassware carrier, the Cairn Caps bamboo lids, and Cairn Cradle glassware hanging racks every single day. And definitely when I'm tasting new things and have a lot of things to get through. Nobody else is making carriers for your Glencairns like Cairncraft is. Plus, they've got infinity decanters, glass lids, Glencairn brushes, and more. Whiskey Ring podcast listeners can get 10% off their purchase with code WHISKEYRING10 at checkout. Just go to cairncraft.com, pick any of those incredible products that I use on a daily basis, and use code WHISKEYRING10 at checkout for 10% off your purchase. Now, back to the episode.
We let them sit and distill as it goes. We do it quite subtle when we heat them up and when we distill. We've tried to burn the wash in the still. That's not very funny. It's like burning. You know what do you call this oat?
Oatmeal kind of thing. Or...
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Imagine that, burn that really hard in a copper pan. You want to never be able to clean that pan. Right. That's the same with the stills. It's almost impossible to clean them if you burn it inside the stills, because it's so thick, you know. Mm-hmm. But we really need to heat it up very subtle and start the direct fire very slow. So it's a long distillation we do, we thought about, you know, making, you know, what I call the rakes or inside the, I can't remember what they call inside the still, mm-hmm. but decided not to do it and really just focus on doing a very gentle warming of heating of the liquid. And that it takes a long time. And and in the beginning, you know, we had five stills and we'll come back to that, you know, because when we were what I call amateurs having the 400 liter and 200 liter, it was easy to control, you know, two small stills and only one was still, one spirit still. When we bought the farm, it started kind of the real distillery. We had three wash stills and two spirit stills, also possible to control. But when you have 16 wash stills and 8 spirit stills, you know, and as you know, even though they are exactly the same, you know, it's still different.
Yep.
Your times, distilling times, everything is just different. ABV, they just perform in different ways. So with one distiller working there, he really needs to be able to check them all, focus on it, you know, and spend some time with his small babies, make sure they don't burn. And it took some time in the beginning to really learn how to do that. And they were frustrated and they were angry and they had long nights cleaning the stills, you know, having to stay after work 2-3 hours cleaning stills. That's not fun. but now we found the trick to handle the new and bigger stills and more stills. So it actually works out well now.
I was going to say the pot stills, I mean, the pot stills, the Olympic stills, they're the oldest style, as you said, and they're still around for a reason. You know, the column stills are certainly there for volume and especially for when you want to get up to a particular alcohol level for maybe vodka or just pure ethanol. But a pot still really gives you a character that can't be replicated in any kind of column still or even perhaps a hybrid still. Like a pure pot still is very unique.
Yeah. It certainly is.
So actually, good question. Where do you get the stills from?
So and to come back to that, so in 2007, we bought this farm and started distilling in 2009. Did that for some years. And in 2015, we got an investment from Diageo. They had, through a company called Distill Ventures, a small company that looks for fascinating, interesting, exciting experiments and craft distilleries. And they traveled the world for, I think, 1.5 years. And suddenly they knocked our door. Well, I had a meeting with them in Copenhagen. They said, you are probably the most interesting small distillery in the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. Can we invest in your distillery? We were like, no way. That's not possible. But I think 1 month prior to this, we had a meeting where we were like, we can't keep up. You know, our whiskey sold out as we put it on the market. So we need to scale up somehow. And we were talking about banks and selling some stocks in the company, getting private investors. But all loans in the bank, but all this was kind of not clever money. And when Distill Ventures came, they offered knowledge through the Diageo, some help in scaling up this, and using 200 years of experience from distilleries, single malt distilleries in Scotland. You can tap directly into that through them. But we just wanted to make sure that we had kind of major, we still had the influence of the company. We were still, had most of the stocks in the company. So we had the ability to decide on where we want to go and what we wanted to do. And they accepted that. But getting some more money like that, we were able to tap into other ways of solutions. Diageo owns part of Abercrombie, or maybe all of Abercrombie, a pot still manufacturer in Scotland. Mm. And I think that the world's oldest functioning pot still manufacturer. I remember I asked, was it the managing director, Michael, I think his name is, about how old they were. And he said, well, do you remember when they chopped off the head of Marie Antoinette? You know, we were making pot stills at that time. So
interesting time marker, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of knowledge, we decided to go with them and said, great, can you make, can you make 24 pot stills? And they were like, oh, that's ridiculous. And can you make them direct heated? Oh, that's even more ridiculous. No, impossible. We can't do that. Nobody can do that. And we were like, damn. Then they called us up a week or two later on and said, well, it's a challenge. We want to do it. And we found out how we can do it, because a few distillery or pot still manufacturers around the world makes direct heated stills. Often they're very small, these manufacturers, almost hobby. But they got some of the retired workers in Abercrombie back. So 70, 80, 90 year old guys came back to Abercrombie to help them design your thickness angles, you know, of the copper for, to resist the fire and to work with fire as they did, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So I think that's a lovely story, bringing back that knowledge from the past into the future with our stills. And it took some time for them to do it. And it's, you know, go to a website and you will see these 24 small onions sitting there on the floor. It's a great sight to see that everybody gets like, wow, when they go into that room. It's a copper cathedral, you know. So fascinating.
It looks like it. I mean, the like I said, the photos are, I'm sure in person dwarfs that by comparison, but the photos on the website are really quite inspiring in a way to see not only the, you know, the scale of what you're doing, where you can be both very large but economical and also very with very little tweaks and these things. It's, I found it very impressive. And I can be very effusive on that. So I'll pull back a little bit on that, but no, that's fascinating. And it's worth noting about Abercrombie because I think most, a lot of people when they think of stills, like, you know, if you're in America, the still chances are Vendome in Kentucky, for copper stills at least. And then in Scotland, you know, Forsyth's.
Yes.
Of course. But Abercrombie is, you're right, it's older and somehow it seems to be less known.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it sounds like in this case, it may have worked to your advantage because where I know it, at least on this side of the Atlantic, the I know Vendome has a waiting list of probably several years long now at this point for just for copper stills, let alone anything fancier or, you know, more complicated, just for a still. And I imagine Forsyth's with all the growth in Irish whiskey and even Scottish whiskey at this point probably had the same thing. So, but it's also just a fun story of having like 70, 80, 90 year old guys coming back.
I often see it, you know, kind of when I go to sleep, this guy sitting with the, you know, the desk with the papers writing. It's like, wow, it must be fun.
I can almost imagine like a comedy scene of someone walking in and, you know, they leave for the, they leave for the night. You have a younger guy, let's say in his 40s, 50s, just sitting at the desk designing it. They come back the next morning. It's the 90 year old guy sitting there like, oh God, what happened overnight? You know? God, that has, if that hasn't happened, and Abercrombie, if you're listening, make that happen because they will absolutely be a great sketch.
Yes, it will.
Like, what took you so long?
And often people, you know, the first response we get from a lot of people is like, why 24? Why direct heated? Why floor malting? Why weird mashing? You know, you could do it so much more easy than the way you do things. And they're absolutely right. You know, we could save a lot of money and do it way more easy. But it, you know, somehow it's just not fun. We feel this is, you know, we get the most out of everything. We control everything. We have flexibility. It's traditions, but we've innovated and made it modern. For example, our floor malting, you know, when people think about floor malting, you look at the picture from Laphroaig or Balvenie or something like that with the rakes going through the grain, people, you know, pulling these rakes, shoveling the grain, tough, hard labor, you know, a monkey shoulder, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we pretty quickly discovered, even, you know, only with 8 square meters of floor malting, this is super hard. You know, the last couple of days, you need to turn the grain up to 2-3 times an hour to control it. Yeah. And that's hard, you know, even for the, you know, the strongest man, 24 hours a day, you know, not possible. So we had to invent special machines to do this, to automate it, to kind of grain raking, turning. I can't describe what it is. You have to get in to see a video of it that kind of rides on top of the grain and turns it on the floor. We steep it on the floor also. And is it worth it? Well, if you look at the investment in it and, you know, the time consuming, you know, how time consuming it is, no, but it's fun, you know, and you improve your knowledge about whiskey in a fantastic way because you feel it between your hands, you smell it, you taste it, You're part of the whole journey doing this. And I think that's more should do that out there. And the yield is poor. You know, you could do much better on yield, but it's not because of the yield we do this. You know, it's because we want to make a great and fun whiskey, you know, having fun every day.
And it's worth noting. I mean, you know, people, if you're listening, you won't necessarily be able to see this, but you know, from the moment we signed on, like the enthusiasm just beams off you while you're talking about this stuff, you know, and the idea that this is really for, like, yes, it's a business, but it's for fun too. Just, it just flows off.
Thank you.
And that's one of my favorite things when talking to people is just seeing like their passion behind it. Which of course leads me to ask, of the 9 original founders, how many of them are still in their original day jobs?
So
or careers?
Yeah, we are. So 3 of us are working full time at the distillery now, and 2 have retired. So the butcher and the chef have retired now and happy, you know, living, you know, probably drinking a lot of whiskey all day long, driving around Denmark and Europe, seeing the world. Then we have 4 people in their normal kind of day job. So we have 2 engineers, still being engineers, and we have the doctor and the helicopter pilot, still doing their normal work. And I think it's probably 2 of them, one of the engineers and the doctor is in our board. We have a professional board now. And they join up 4 times a year and are of course part of this very often. And every second week, every second Wednesday, we have a Skype meeting with all the founders. The 2 retired are not that often part of these meetings, but the rest of them is always part of these meetings. Sorry, second week we discussed past and future, you know, new projects, new types of whiskey. We send around samples, discuss them. So they are a big part of the distillery still. That's fun. And we have innovation weekends and we have holidays where we meet up and drink some whiskey. And often these innovation weekends end up with a bad headache the next day. You know, again, fun. We need to have fun.
Absolutely. So, you know, I do want to be conscious of your time, of course. So I want to mention the other 2 whiskeys I got to sample from you guys. So the first one being Smoke.
Yeah. So Smoke is kind of the first whiskey we ever made. So the smoky single malt, but it's changed over the years. In the beginning, it was simply just a peat smoked single malt whiskey in an ex bourbon cask, first fill, Maker's Mark bourbon cask. Very simple in style, very you know, smoky but simple. No sherry, no nothing to disturb. Really showing off what you know terroir can do to a whiskey. So grainy and smoky, we've changed it later on. We had one of these innovation meetings some years ago and we discussed, is it possible to smoke with other things than peat? What do we have in the region? What are we you know, famous for? What do you see when you drive across the West Coast in Denmark? Mm-hmm. And what you see a lot of is heather. See a lot of heather. And often also the peat you use is because of there's a lot of heather in the peat in a lot of regions in Denmark. But we have a lot, so we use a lot of freshly dried heather to smoke our whiskey with. So it's a combination of heather and peat when we do a smoky whiskey. And instead of now it's impossible to name it peat or peat smoked. So we named it Smoke because it's a combination of different things that we burn and create smoke off for this whiskey. So it's not because it's super smoky; it's because it's a different kinds of smoke going together to this whiskey. And then we have virgin casks, we have ex bourbon casks from Maker's Mark. The virgin cask is heavily charred American white oak barrels. After 3-4 years in the ex bourbon casks, we put some of these whiskies into rum casks and to Madeira casks. where they get a finish and get some of the sweetness from the rum and some of that winey character from the Madeira, which we think fits it very well. And next batch of smoke you will taste, we have another batch coming to the US in not so long, will be a bit more smoky and a bit more, kind of from the Madeira, have some more of the flavors from Madeira. So we still not finished, you know, trialing, testing, changing our whiskies. We're on a constant journey on making our whiskey better and better in style to fit us and the people that likes our whiskies. And it's still a young whiskey. So why don't play around, change, try things out. We have amazing experiments with a lot of different casks, Armagnac, Calvados, Cognac, Mezcal, tequila. We have all different kinds of fortified wines we try out, sherry and port and masala. We have rums, 12, 15 different kinds of rums, Japanese rum. So we try a lot of things, Danish cherry wine casks, a wine cask, because we're a bit fed up with sherry and port. That's kind of the usual stuff, and you see that a lot. It's not bad. It's lovely,
right? But you've said several times, like, you don't want to copy people.
Yeah, exactly. The latest and you will see that in the beginning of 2022, we just did we call it El Clásico. And the Clásico is part of our research series, and it's a rye aged in vermouth casks. It's a bit like your dad's hat. Also have a rye aged in vermouth cask. And we find the profile of that vermouth, Spanish vermouth, and with our rye fits it, perfect. It's like a Manhattan. Drinking a high proof Manhattan. We have a Bastard. Bastard is also whiskey. Bastard, it's a rye whiskey aged in mezcal casks, and that's kind of just Bastard mixing rye and mezcal. So we try to find the perfect fit. Then we do a research series, and in time we'll probably vet some of these casks together to do a final version of the rye. So a rye could be rye and mezcal, rye and vermouth, rye and muscatel, something like that. That would basically in the future create our core rye whiskey. Smoke was kind of our single malt, and that's 20% of the whiskey we produce every year is a peat smoked single malt whiskey.
I mean, it's really fascinating, and I think one of the great things of having younger whiskey that doesn't, to put it bluntly, that younger whiskey that doesn't taste young, it tastes mature, it has another youthful quality in a bad way. It's very good, even at 3 to 4 years old, is great. Because one of the, I don't know if you can call it a complaint, but one of the great things, but also one of the terrible things about the that long aging whiskey, the 18, 20, 25 year things, is that distillers, I've heard distillers from, 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, saying, it's great doing what we're doing, but really you only get two shots. You get maybe, if you're in it for a couple of decades, you get two rounds. You see the ending of two rounds of what you've done.
Yeah.
And which is, on one hand, it's very poetic, it's very dramatic too, but but it's also somewhat true. But you guys being able to have that, the great new make that's right off the still. So you're starting with a great product, and then taking that in just a couple of years, being able to say, okay, this is where we were 3-4 years ago, and adjusting. You could do generations of whiskey tasting and whiskey adjustments in much less time. And I would imagine that's very fulfilling, and it definitely seems exciting.
It is very fulfilling, actually. Yeah. Yes. To do that, I know it would be impossible for me to wait 18, 20 years. But right. We have some, of course, aging, becoming older. But again, not having the possibility to change and play around, it's just unbearable. Thought,
right, of course. All right. So, just in our last couple of minutes together, we have to talk about the chaos. Is that the other two were very good, but the chaos was just excellent for my taste.
Okay, fantastic.
It really was. Part of it, I mean, correct me on this, but part of it, I think, goes to the style of peat that goes to my palate as well. I mean, I've recently started to get more of an appreciation for Islay peat, for that medicinal. Sorry, I still can't quite get past the medicinal part, but definitely the the smoky and the brininess I can get behind now. Yeah. But if anything, really, the last episode that just had come out before recording this was with Highland Park.
Yep.
And that style of peat with the, it's not really coastal, it's a little coastal, but it's more about the heather. It's all heather. They have no trees up there. It's the winds just blow too much. There's no trees up there. It's heather peat. It's a little salinity from the coastline, but not nearly what you get in Islay whiskeys. And it, you know, the cask reminded me of that. It wasn't a direct one-to-one, but it reminded me of that wood smoke, you know, burning ember, salinity without becoming fishy at all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I get it.
And that was just, I had to cut down my bottle buying because I was running out of room in a two-bedroom apartment. I was thinking, like, if I had to get one of these three, I had to go for the chaos. So, chaos. Tell me more about it, how that came about and what is it?
Well, it's kind of fun because chaos, who would name a whiskey chaos? Who would want to buy a chaotic whiskey? Is that a great idea? Stowning, the name Stowning is, we've named Stowning because of the village Stowning where we started and where we live. Like most distilleries around the world, they're named after the area or the village where they come from. But in Denmark, the most famous prime minister we've ever had, his name was Thorvald Stauning. And he was elected in, I think, 1935 and had an election quote that said, choose Stauning or get chaos. And if you go to Google today and you write Stauning or chaos, if you put that in, you will see this poster. Black and white poster of a man with a big beard and round glasses, and it says "Choose Stauning or get chaos." He was a social democratic, and he's done a lot for the welfare in Denmark with some of the laws he was part of in the 30s. But this quote, everybody in Denmark, even small children, know this quote: "Stauning or chaos." And we had to use it. And then, how do you make a chaotic whiskey? That's number two. What we did was we took a simple batch of chaos is three casks of rye whiskey, one cask of single malt whiskey, non-smoked, and two casks of single malt whiskey, smoked. So six casks vatted together creates a chaos. And that is, pretty chaotic. Number one, we can't actually put this into a competition. There's no category for this type of whiskey. Rye going together with single malt whiskey, it's just everybody, when we put it for competition, especially in Europe, people are like, is it blended? No, it's not blended because it's from the same distillery. It's a single malt. No, it's not single malt because you have rye in there. So it's right. So they come up with all the sorts of different solutions for this, but it can't fit a category. So it is a very chaotic action also for us in our daytime job to put into competitions and write explanations on the bottle and what is it. So you have that sweetness from the rye. Then you have the smokiness, but it's kind of simple, not too, as you say, medicinal, seaweed, iodine, a kind of smokiness. It's just a simple bonfire type of smoke you get from the chaos. And that's one of the reasons, for example, the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, they use all our whiskeys. They actually removed all other whiskeys when we started with them in 2012.
And only I had saw Stauning. That on the website. That's incredible.
When the head sommelier said to Martin was sitting with him, he said, this is amazing. What if we remove all our whiskeys and only use your whiskeys in Noma? Is that okay with you? Yes. they are one of our biggest customers actually today. They buy 700 bottles of whiskey each year for a restaurant. And what they do is they serve it after dinner And they say the rye is so easy to go to. It's not a typical kind of American rye. That fits the Noma profile. It's Danish, it's Nordic, it has a special style. Some say it's a bit like a rum in character, a spicy rum. The chaos is not too, so the rye, you can use that for beginners or non-whiskey drinkers to kind of get them into the whiskey drinking. The chaos is for people that doesn't like smoky whiskeys, but like whiskey or has just started up drinking whiskey, will like the chaos, and there's a lot of complexity and things they need to look in and find, get rye and the smoke. And the smoke is for the hardcore whiskey drinker, but not too hardcore, not the old guy that only drinks really, really smoky whiskeys because he's too old now. smoking his cigar, you can also use it for whiskey drinkers that would like to learn more about smoky whiskeys. So we have a kind of good range of whiskeys for a restaurant like that. They can kind of find everybody with a whiskey from Stauning. So
And no arguments here. I think all three of those descriptions are right at the mark. I mean, it's what I definitely experienced. I went through, I actually switched them. I did the rye first, then I did the chaos and then the smoke. But I can see the progression there and it works amazingly. I did not make it to Noma yet. I will probably in about 10 years, but they're still around. If they do another pop-up in Mexico, that's a little easier to get to, but but then of course it won't be dangerous, so we'll see what would happen. But all right, I know we are at the top of the hour. I want to let you go enjoy what looks to be a very sunny evening. Yes, over there
it is. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
So Alex, thank you so much for taking the time. It was really wonderful to try these things, to talk about them, to be exposed to them. I'm definitely going to be picking up a bottle of the chaos, share it with some friends of mine.
Thank you.
Hopefully by a summer fire, because we're just thank getting you. Into the summer yes. months here.
Yeah, fantastic. So,
and really, thank you so much. Stick on with me for a couple of seconds after we end.
I will.
All right.
Well, thank awesome. You. Thank you for letting me come. It was so fun.
Absolutely. And you can find Stauning Whiskey. I will have all of their information in the show notes for this episode, the website where you can find on Instagram and social media. And as always, thanks for listening. Share with your friends and cheers.